Good afternoon, Dr. Anguera, Authentic Biochemistry Podcast. Today, 3 March 2024. Hope you enjoyed the lecture last night. A little bit different from what we normally do. So if you just tuned in for that one lecture, you might think we spend a lot of time talking about non-discursive dialectical event ontologies and associations between metaphysics and biochemistry. And I won't argue that we occasionally do not do that. But it was a rare event. And basically what I was trying to do there was show you all of the complexity just around glycolytic regulation. You know, that's canonical biochemistry. And then comparing that to what causes disease relative to choices people make based on their response to their environment. And ultimately, diet, exercise, and lifestyle play a significant role in altering the finely tuned biochemical regulation that normally keeps people healthy. So that's kind of what I was getting at. But I also was trying to show you how inductive and deductive reasoning are used in the production of hypotheses, experimental design, the execution of the experiments, the examination of data, and then the evaluation of the data into what could be described as general rules about biochemical regulation. And that the idea that science is completely unbiased really cannot be supported unless you are suggesting that people aren't doing the science. Of course, people are. And because of that, depending on where you enter your research career, specifically when you're first starting out, there's a lot of induction that goes on, which means the idea that all the previous research had shown a given paradigm, that you as a young researcher are going to follow along with those paradigms and try to come up with ideas to examine more completely whether or not those paradigms fit what's happening in nature. This can have everything to do with normal physiology to pathophysiology, you know, pathobiochemistry, of course. And so as you get older and you work in research, you start developing ideas de novo. And those de novo ideas may actually be the components of how research moves into new realms. It can also be a fertile field of mistakes, but yet can progress within individual research agenda. So those aspects of what I was trying to get at last night, what I'm telling you now, were I think not necessarily required to be stated, but I stated them now just to synthesize what I did last night. If more detail is asked, just send me emails to authenticbiochemistry@gmail.com. And I'd be glad to answer your questions online and develop more lectures to get more elaborate at what I'm getting at. Basically, what I'm saying is that what we understand about all the regulation of biochemistry, so I went through all the different types of kinases and phosphatases, simply regulating phosphofructokinase 1. And that particular canonical feature of biochemistry is well worked out. Yet, any minor alteration of, say, a cyclic AMP-dependent protein kinase versus an AMP kinase can have dramatic effect on the regulation of glycolysis relative to the utilization of carbon for ultimately lipogenesis or the production of amino acids that can be used directly for de novo synthesis of nucleic acids. And with the effect of the increase in NADPH because of the oxidative dependence phosphate shunt, also providing the ribose 5-phosphate, that can set cells up to proliferate. And that, of course, leads directly into a nice, robust discussion of how metabolism that is slightly changed because of diet, for example, think about the obesity epidemic, can greatly enhance the corruption of that pathway such that tumorigenesis followed after oncogenesis can play a major role in the ultimate pathology of a system that is impacted by that obesity. And of course, cardiovascular disease, exactly the same thing. Think about what I was telling you about how the differential utilization of phosphofructor kinase occurs in skeletal muscle, cardiac muscle versus, say, the liver. Okay, and of course, adipose as well. And all of this has to be considered collectively when one is trying to understand the pathobiochemistry of a given disease. And the idea that you could take a look at, you know, people organizing around a signaling event like the bell tower, moving into a specific area in the inappropriate time. So it's a temporal signature. It's also a spatial signature. Can corrupt whatever the normal regulation of that process was. And that was a religious service, you see. And that fundamentally, because humans have an intellect, and that intellect is supported by free choice of the will to make decisions on what to study and what to understand about what is analyzed in nature, the preoccupation with simply looking at science as a fixed entity is inappropriate to understand it, because really we shouldn't ever really talk about science without modifying that term with the adjective research. Research science, experimental research science, which is an event that is constantly changing based on the will of the people that are doing the work. Okay. I spent 7 minutes. I said I was going to spend any time. I just spent 7 minutes explaining what I talked about last night. But I want to make sure why I did it. I tried to elaborate on certain things I thought was that were important for you to be able to get the detail and what I call the complex regulation. Okay, so let's go back to our mosaic. This is mosaic 2. It's going to be chapter 4. We're talking about plasmalogen. So for the next 22 minutes, which I've given myself, we can do that. Now, when we were talking about plasmalogens last time, I told you that there is an association of the production of plasmalogens in certain cancers. I told you that alkyl glycerone phosphate synthase inactivation can decrease the expression of various regulatory pathways that lead to the biosynthesis of prostaglandins and other ether lipids, and that is linked to tumor cell proliferation. Remember that? And so we're talking about prostaglandins, and which are vinyl ether lipids, and also other ether lipids. Now, AGPS overexpression will, of course, increase the production of plasmalogens. And in terms of pathology, the overexpression of that enzyme also increases the survival and migratory capability of tumor cells. And I told you all the different tumor cells that it's been studied in: ovarian, breast cancer, melanoma, prostate, etc. So then I was starting to talk about differential expression of AGPS in thyroid cancer. Now, here's the new information finally. There is, of course, found in cells a certain type of RNA called circular RNA. And circ RNAs are significant molecular mediators of multiple genetic alterations, because circular RNAs can affect the expression of genes at the level of regulating microRNAs and messenger RNAs. So that's something we have to now take into account with our prostaglandin understanding of certain cancers such as thyroid. So circular RNAs are abnormally expressed in tumors. And in fact, they being the new kid on the block for being non-coding RNAs and cRNAs. The fact that they're not linear means that their interaction with other macromolecules, or indeed low molecular mass molecules, is going to be significantly different than linearized nucleic acids. Because linearized nucleic acids obviously can be easily metabolized by DNAs and RNAs. But circular, covalently closed RNAs, even though they're not coding for anything, can be more stable in the cell, and therefore, if they have the potential to alter the expression of messenger RNA or the activity of a microRNA to control the expression of a messenger RNA, we have to take that into account, the stability of these circular RNAs, okay? So, the mechanism that seems to work is that the small RNAs, the microRNAs, are actually mopped up by these circular RNAs. And so, because of that, there's a direct regulation of the activity of the production of transcripts coming from RNA polymerase activity. And so what we're saying is you get a regulation of the transcriptional event at the level of RNA binding proteins. And all of that will then coalesce around polyribosomes so that protein translation is also altered because of these circular RNAs. So this study that we're going to be talking about, along with a few others this afternoon, involve the expression of the AGPS. Remember, that is one of the rate-limiting enzymes in plasmalogen biosynthesis that is directly also linked to peroxisomal biogenesis type diseases. Because peroxisomal biogenesis is closely linked to the production of plasmalogens, right? So that's something we introduced last time as a new concept. So what this paper wants to look at, it's a paper published in Onco Letters, and we already introduced it a couple days ago, is looking at AGPS expression and circular RNAs in thyroid cancer in humans. So, of course, the experiments they're doing aren't all in humans. One of the things that they did experimentally was knock out or silence AGPS in cells. And they wanted to know what effect AGPS had on the regulation now directly of the circular RNA expression. And the cells that we're using were thyroid cancer cells. Okay. So they used a gene ontology type of KEG pathway enrichment analysis to examine the effect of the modification of the AGPS gene expression on circular RNAs, and then downstream from that event, what genes are being affected in terms of expression and whether or not there's an alteration in intermediary metabolism. Okay, ultimately getting down to what is the molecular mechanism AGPS mediated circular RNA contribution to thyroid cancer. Okay. So that's basically the whole process. Now, these circular RNAs, again, they're novel. and they're newly minted in terms of our discovery of them. Although they had been known to exist, but had been put off, after separating out different fractions of RNA, they were that fraction of RNA that was like sitting in someone's test tube rack in the freezer that we'll get to this. We'll figure out what these circRNAs are doing in the cell. But right now they were looking, for example, at siRNAs. So what has been determined, now this is coming from a paper published just about a year and a half ago, is that these circRNAs are generated by a mechanism called backsplicing of messenger RNA precursors. Okay, so there's a pathogenic single-stranded cyclic-like virus that has been discovered in plants that is very similar. Its genome is very similar to these closed covalent circular RNAs that you discover in humans. And these RNA viruses were discovered back in the 70s. So once it was determined that there were these circular RNAs in animal cells and human cells, and they seem to be linked to cancer, and then there was this older literature in plants that said that these were plant viral genomes, you can see how this got enough people interested that wrote grants, and some of the grants were funded to do some research on these projects. Now, even though we know that circular RNAs have been, we know that they exist, we don't really know all the detail. We know that they have this covalently closed loop structure that doesn't have, because of when it occurred at the pre-RNA level, pre-mRNA level, there's no 5' cap and there's no 3' polyadenylated tail on these RNAs. So that means that they're formed by what they're calling reverse splicing. So splicing, of course, is going to be in the processing of the RNA, making it mature and ready for what? For translation. And, to get the RNA out of the mRNA out of the nucleus, you have to do a 5' capping, and you have to do, to make the RNA stable and to be translatable, you have to have a 3' polyadenylation addition. Right. And so what's interesting about these circRNAs, this basically doesn't get to the point where those messenger RNAs have ever matured. So again, that leaves out the caps on the 5' and 3' end. So that's kind of interesting, right? And what they call that mechanism, because it's occurring essentially at the splicing mechanistic interval of pre-RNA to mRNA mature, they're calling it reverse splicing. Okay. Now, what are some details about these circular RNAs associated with plasmalogen production in thyroid cancer? Well, in the literature, circular RNA will block a particular microRNA called miR-7, blocking it by basically binding to it. So a term then was put into the literature now, a term I particularly like, but they start calling these circular RNAs microRNA sponges, soaking up the microRNAs. Now, in terms of the actual mechanism for the production of these unusual RNA molecules, they're generated by exon skipping and by intron internal circulation. Okay, so these circRNAs, unlike linear messenger RNAs, will possess a closed loop structure, and there will be no free ends. And I told you that makes a big difference, because RNases and RNases or ribonucleoRNases are not going to be good enzymes to corrupt or to break down these circular RNAs, because they only have free ends. Okay? But yet, they seem to be able to interact with other RNA species that do have free ends, like microRNAs. So, it's curious, right? So, these circular RNAs have an interesting subcellular accommodation. So, exon-derived, you have exon-derived and intron-derived circular RNAs. Okay, now we're starting to get into the specific subspecies of these circRNAs. The exon-derived circular RNAs are found in the cytoplasm, whereas the intron-derived circular RNAs are in the nucleus. Now, what does that tell you? You know that you have to splice out the introns in order to make the pre-messenger RNA to leave the nucleus, right? And once that occurs, all you have left in the messenger RNA are exons. Because when you have the more mature RNA and it's already in cytoplasm, that's getting prepped to do translation, right? To get into the polyribosome or the ribosomes in the ER and for translation to be carried out by transfer RNAs and by all the enzymes involved in protein synthesis, right? All the binding proteins and all the enzymes necessary for the production of polypeptide, amino to carboxy terminus. Right? So you have two different species. So that's interesting. So because of that, people have looked at how they are synthesized. When I say because of that, once you discover there's a complexity in the different species of a novel organic molecule that has an effect on gene expression, you have to start looking at mechanisms for synthesis, stability, degradation, and utilization. So they came up after the initial levels of studying with a few mechanisms for biosynthesis. One involved intron pairing driven circularization, RNA binding protein mediated circularization. Remember, I told you the riboprotein nucleic acids are going to be involved here. And then finally, something called, which we know about RNA processing anyways, that for ribosomes, a lariat-driven circularization, three different types, intron pairing, RNA binding protein, that'd be RBP, and this lariat-driven. Okay? So due to the complementary base pairing of the intron sequences on both sides of the circularized exon, the 5' splice site can directly join with the 3' splice site, and then now you've synthesized the initial circRNA. Now, more detail. The primate-specific ALU repeats, and I'm going to tell you what those are if you don't recall, have more than 1 million copies in the mammalian genome. And that accounts for actually more than 10% of the dispersed human genome. Not the mitochondria, the nuclear genome. So ALU repeats are the main way of circularization in human genes. So it looks like those repeats then are going to play a role that we've already been examining in molecular genetics and molecular biology. So the circRNAs have been discovered successively, first in yeast mitochondria, then in hepatitis delta virus human 26-1 gene, the mouse sex determining region Y, that's called SRY, and then getting into the more detail, the rat cytochrome P450 C224 gene, and the human P450 to C18 gene. Okay? So now we're telling you what are specific species of these circular RNAs, and we just told you two human ones. Now, this reverse complementary match, or RCM, will promote the formation of a hairpin structure in the transcript, and that's going to then facilitate the circularization. And this was studied most completely in the mouse sex determining region Y. That's the SRY. So you'll see a lot of SRY literature. Okay. Let me check my time here. I know because we spent a lot of time doing the mopping up of the last lecture. And I'm not going to apologize today because I think I needed to do it. And there's more to say about that too. I just gave you a very brief synthesis. Okay, so let's go back and I just checked. We have a few more minutes. So I told you we're going to go back down and check out what ALU repeats are, because I've introduced them again, and I can't be guaranteed that you have a good background in them. What are they? Well, when they were first examined, they were determined to be a family of short interspersed elements. So those have an acronym too, as well. They're called SINES, S-I-N-E-S, short interspersed elements, okay? And they replicate via what's known as a line-mediated reverse transcription of an RNA polymerase III transcript, primary transcript. So each ALU element is only about 280 base pairs long, but it's followed by a poly-A tail, which can be variable. So the 1 million or so ALU elements in the mammalian genome, as I said, are actually comprising about 10% of that human genome, not just mammalian, but human. So the ALU repeats don't have any specific biological function. Now, again, that's a heavily weighted sentence because ALU insertions and ALU-mediated recombination products contribute significantly to human genetic disease. So, ALU-mediated unequal recombination is actually believed to be the primary cause or correlation to the enrichment of gene segmental duplications in humans. So, that's a very important mechanism. Gene duplication is linked to ALUs. Okay. Now, remember, why am I talking about ALUs? Because the ALU-rich regions that are involved in the production of circular RNAs. Remember? Okay. So ALU repeats have been studied at a great amount of time, over 20 years, I would say almost 25 years. And their insertional mutagenesis effect is what you find in that early literature. And it is quite florid, as you might guess. Now, that's enough about the ALU. We're going to go back to it. We're going to move back and forth into what the ALUs are involved in this circularization process. But I want to make sure that you had at least, you know, the very basic understanding of what's going on, right? Because without that, you're not going to be able to follow what I'm going to talk about now. Okay. All right. So let me check my time again. Yeah, I think I'm going to stop there. We have about 2 minutes left, but what I'm going to get involved in now is a lot of molecular biology, a lot of discussion of the movement around of nucleic acid segments within the genome. And in order to be able to do that, I'm going to have to give you a little bit more of a background than what I would normally have to do if this is just something like intermediary metabolism. So I'm going to have to open up probably a 10-minute discussion before we get back to talking about these couple of papers where plasmalogens play a role. This is still the mosaic on plasmalogens. Remember, plasmalogens are linked to these circular RNAs. And these circular RNAs are associated with ALU-rich sequences, and ALU-rich sequences are involved in insertional mutagenesis in the human genome. So that suggests that plasmalogen biosynthesis or membrane alteration because of plasmalogen mobility, because of that flipase, in association with peroxisomal maturation and proliferation, could be very significant in certain human diseases, in particular, many of the cancers that I've been talking about in the last couple of lectures. Right now, we're talking about thyroid, but you'll see hepatocellular carcinoma will be another major one we're going to talk about in the future. So I'm going to leave you with that. Sunday afternoon, and a 3rd of March again, 2024. This is Dr. Dan Guerra from Authentic Biochemistry Podcast Studios. Wishing you a pleasant and warm Sunday evening with your family, saying bye for now.